Welcome to the Caving Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Pelser of the Central Indiana Grotto. What's a grotto? Grotto is a local chapter of the National Speleological Society. And if you want to get involved in caving, you got to at least be in contact with a grotto. You could join. Dues are usually cheap. Ours are like 15 bucks a year. And as is with a lot of grottos, they encourage you to join the national organization, the NSS. And being a member of that organization carries with it a lot of great contacts, resources. And the reason we encourage organized caving is not to raise money for the national organization. It's because caving can be dangerous if you don't know what you're doing. And so you got to network. And when you do it first, do it with people who have done it before and know what they're doing, because it's really, really easy to get lost, easy to get hurt. So it's important to get experience before you start leading trips of your own. And, you know, you got to find people to go with, because not a lot of people like to do this. But if you're at all interested, I highly encourage you to try it. But you got to do it the right way. And I've got a link in the description of this podcast to find your local grotto through the NSS website, caves.org. That's pretty easy to remember, right? Caves.org. I had a great day yesterday hanging out with Rachel Saker, who is in the area working on wind turbines. And she came down to Indianapolis and we had some beers. Rachel, it was great hanging out. She's, of course, a tag caver from near the Chattanooga area. And you can follow her on Instagram. She's got about 8,500 followers at Petzl Princess. And I just got this in my email inbox, and I haven't even written Martin back yet to thank him for it. But this is from a former guest on the podcast, Martin Hoff. And I love this. If you wanted to make one of these, be my guest. An audio postcard from Martin Hoff.
Hello, the Caving Podcast. It's Martin here. I'm at the entrance of the Gouffre Berger in the Vercors Plateau of France, the first cave to go over a kilometre deep, and for a while, the deepest cave in the world. Bet you can't guess what I'm here for.
Hey, Matt. The noise you can hear is the water flowing into the first sump in the Gouffre Berger. That means I'm 1,122 metres below the entrance I came in this morning, and still thinking about my favourite podcast. All I got to do now is swim back out through the pseudo-siphon, and remember, kill nothing but time. But you can always half-kill yourself with a massive pack, because you took a wetsuit to somewhere that was a bit less crowded than the beach, for a nice swim on your own.
Hey, Matt. You know who this is by now. I'm sat here in the sunshine after 30 hours underground. It took 7 or 8 hours to get back up the 600-odd metres to the camp, for a few hours sleep in 6 Celsius or 43 Fahrenheit, and then a few more hours to be back outside. If you're gonna kill time, that's a good way to do it. It's a hell of a place.
Oh, Martin. Oh, that's so cool. Thank you so much for that. What a delight. I was going to go caving this past month. I had a big trip planned with Laura Demarest and Joe Kinder, and we were going to go. I don't know what we were going to do. I mean, it was Joe's idea. We were going to maybe dig. We were going to maybe just go on a tourist trip. And it was all set, man. And it was going to be on my birthday, which was on Saturday, the 9th. And then that Thursday night, I started feeling crappy. Took a COVID test. Positive. Oh, my heart just sank. I wanted to go so bad. It was my birthday weekend. I was going to go caving with my friends who I haven't seen in a long time. And it just really upset me. And COVID hit me hard, man. I hadn't had it yet. I dodged it for more than 2 years. And it was miserable. I mean, I was just gassed. Completely out of energy. I was just laying in bed, watching TV that whole weekend. It just wasn't any fun. I would not recommend it. Would not recommend catching COVID. One great thing that happened this past month, caving adjacent, I guess, is I watched National Geographic Explorer, The Deepest Cave, which Riley Blackwell talked about on the podcast. And it features a bunch of people that have been on this podcast. Bill Stone, of course. It was so cool to have him. And it was cool to see him doing his thing. Riley Blackwell was on camera. Gilly Elor was on camera. She did a talking head. Does that make Riley and Gilly Disney princesses? Because it's on Disney+. If you haven't seen it yet, you've got to see it. National Geographic Explorer, The Deepest Cave. I think you can just stream it online, too, without having Disney Plus. I'll put a link in the description to where you can watch it online, because it's so good. Sean Lewis, who hasn't been on the podcast, but he and I have exchanged some emails. Sean, shout out. He was on it. Sean, I got to talk to you about your experience there, because we were watching, and Sean was called out, you know, just logistics of the exploration effort, you know. He wanted to stay at the frontier. They had to call him out. And my wife was like, why? Why'd they make him leave? It was like a soap opera. We were into it. It's incredible. It's just incredible. The Deepest Cave, Nat Geo Explorer. It's streaming on Disney Plus. And again, link in the description. I've had a great couple of months doing grotto presentations. I did a presentation for the Philly Grotto back in June. I don't know if I mentioned that last month. Thank you, Sophie. And Sophie actually hooked me up with this month's guest. Just did a presentation for the Central Ohio Grotto, the COG, this past week. Thank you, Wendy. I got another one coming up this month for the Out of Bounds Grotto. Let's see, what else? Oh, Indiana Cave Capers this weekend. You better believe I'm going to be there. I'm going to get there Friday afternoon, if all goes well. August 5th through the 7th, Camp Rivervale. I'll put a pre-registration link up in the description of this podcast. You click that thing. I'd love to see you there. I'm going to have my recorder with me. I don't know if I'll record anything because I've got a lot of interviews in the can already, or I've got some planned on the calendar, but it'd be fun to have a talk if you want to have a talk. So come to Indiana for Indiana Cave Capers. It'll be a lot of great trips. Maybe you and I will go caving together. I'd love that. Okay, Mark Dickey. Wow. We had such a great talk. Mark is a humble guy, but man, the guy knows an awful lot. He is an NCRC instructor. He helped create this course, this Alpine SRT caving course called Caving Academy, and they hold their first class in September if you're willing to travel to Hungary. And I think that they've got it. Well, we'll talk about it. We'll talk about it. What a resource. What a caving mind. Here we go. So, Mark Dickey, welcome to the Caving Podcast. I really appreciate it, man.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you are running what's called, let's just get this out of the way first, you're running what you're calling the Caving Academy. And when is it happening?
Absolutely. Caving Academy, as an organization, it's happening all the time. We're planning on having continual courses every single year. But the first course that we're offering is coming up September 10th through September 16th of this year. It's based out of Hungary. It's an international course. So it's coming up pretty soon.
Hungary. So this is a commitment. This is an airplane ticket. This is the whole thing.
It is. This is a full commitment, although we want to make it as easy as possible for everyone. So like the moment you arrive in the airport, like we will pick you up at the airport. We're going to get you to your lodging. We'll handle like a SIM card if you want one for your cell phone to stay in communication back with the States. If you want to just disappear entirely, that's awesome too. Because the training itself is just 7 full days of nonstop training. 2 of the days are allocated to transportation. So it's like 9 days worth of course. 10th day for exploring Budapest from a caver perspective, you know, private tours of different underground places. So it's like, we will take care of you from the first to the last minute, but it's a commitment. Like this is, you know, if you haven't been traveling internationally before, this is the best way to go about it, but it's still, you know, it can be scary.
I don't know, man. You just hit the bullet points as if I don't care about the details, but I do, man. I'm intrigued now. I'm super intrigued. Wait a minute. So Budapest, from a caver's perspective, are there caves under the city? What are you talking about?
Hell yeah.
There
Budapest
are?
Budapest is one of the, yeah, Budapest is, as far as I know, the only capital city in the world to have really significant cave systems directly under the city.
Well, there's the sewers of Paris. There's the catacombs of Paris, but that's artificial. Are these natural caves? What are we talking
about?
These
are natural caves.
Wow.
These are 100% natural. So you, like the first time that I was there, I arrived, Danish, who has been a longtime friend now from the first exchange program that I did with the NCRC to travel to Budapest. We basically just get on a train, get onto a bus, get off, walk, I don't know, 5 minutes to this gorgeous entrance to a cave, and you have kilometers upon kilometers upon kilometers of caves directly under the city.
Wow. And how often have you been before?
If the question is how many times have I been to Budapest and Hungary / maybe even Europe, but let's start with Hungary. I've been there a lot. It's like a second home at this point. Fantastic people, amazing experiences. Like I love being there. They're continually asking, when am I going to move there? Probably 7 times now that I've been over there and spending time in Budapest specifically. But the first time that I was there was when I went there for their technical 2 training. And that was back in, I believe it was 2015.
So you kind of went through the timeline of what will happen with Caving Academy. And I want to get into those details. But before we start to intrigue people and maybe somebody starting to think about buying a plane ticket or something and making this happen, let's temper that a little bit. Do you have any space on this year's Academy?
We do. There's been a lot of interest. So right now we had a student limit of 16, and our aim had been a 2-to-1 instructor to student ratio, get really good personal attention for every single person. Everyone kind of gets a skills booklet that lists a huge swath of skills, building from your SRT skills into your rigging skills, into how do you rescue someone from that rigging, and then a lot of other skills in that range. And so to work through all those skills, to be able to allow each person to focus on the areas that they're either interested in or that their current skill levels guide them to focus on, we have a lot of instructors. So 16 right now, might bump it to 20 students. We've got 14 registrations at this moment, so we could probably handle 2 to 6 more students. But the spots might disappear fast. A lot of people are interested, but as you said, buying that plane ticket over to Europe is a big step. So
yeah, that's a big filter for this.
It is indeed
A risk to, well, I mean, it may very well be that by the time this is published on August 1st, those 2 spots might be gone. So if you want to do it and you find that you can't, my apologies. I want to know then why someone might want to do this. What are the skills that they will find in doing this that will help them to be, I mean, are you looking for people who will then be able to help on rescues? Are you looking for people who will then be more efficient on survey and exploration trips? Is it all of the above? What are we doing?
It's all the above. The value that Caving Academy can offer, the value that the course offers, really does depend on the individual. And this is a dangerous topic because you're almost building into that baseline, I hate to say, like, religious war within America, which is the American indestructible rope technique versus Alpine SRT. This course is Alpine SRT all the way. It is a requirement that you'll use a frog system for the course. We require a bobbin. Expect to use smaller diameter rope. Even our heavier rope that can withstand the wear and tear of training is 10.5 mil, and then it just goes down from there. So right off the bat, one of the biggest aspects of this is that people can get great introductions to American IRT, drop down to tag, and that's what you're going to see every single day all day. But Alpine SRT has been making steady inroads into American caving over the decades. And as that increases, hopefully their desire to learn Alpine SRT to a true proficient and maybe even highly, highly capable level is increasing. And so that's one of the aspects of what Caving Academy offers, is to truly teach Alpine SRT, which is really European SRT. That's how the Europeans live. They don't even have this concept of IRT. They don't just take a rope, tie it to a tree, throw it down a pit and done. You know, the caves that they're pushing, you know, it's when you're going down 1,000 meters, the tree at the top is completely irrelevant. You know, you're talking, you know, bolting your caves all the way. It's rebelays, deviations, J-hangs, tension traverses, you know, slack traverses, guided rappels. Like, you're talking Alpine SRT to get to the bottom of these caves. And when you're dropping 1,000 meters, you don't want to be carrying 11 mil rope with that weight, with that space, that size. You want to be dropping down to 9 mil rope, 8 mil rope. Not only are you saving money on the smaller diameter ropes that have less material going into them, but you save your weight, and you can travel more lightly through the cave, giving you just more endurance to make it farther. So it's a huge aspect of that, but it's also, Caving Academy is an introduction to the international caving world. That was my introduction. When I got over to Hungary, I met Danish. I met all the other people from the technical too. Zsolt has been a longtime friend. Like, the people from that course have created new inroads to European expeditions. Till this year, it was horrible. I had 5 different expeditions that I had invites to that all happened in the same exact month, like on the same overlapping weeks. It was ridiculously unpleasant. So I finally had to narrow it down to heading to Turkey, to Morka, the deepest cave there, currently at 1,100 meters deep, and lead still going. So that's going to be really exciting.
I'm glad that you brought up the difference between what the Europeans do versus what the Americans have done. But I see what you're saying. It does seem like standards among some of the more serious cavers, even here in the States, those Alpine standards are being adopted. Have you seen the same?
Absolutely.
I'm seeing more bobbins. I'm seeing things like that. I'm seeing smaller rope. Not as much the smaller rope, but I'm definitely seeing people with Petzl stops. Whereas it used to just be racks. I personally don't have a Petzl stop yet, but I want to get one.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No, the most recent NCRC training where we had about 80 students in total, another 40 instructors, every year the cross-section of your rack / bobbin has been steadily transitioning. We could put it onto a graph, and I think this is the first year that the bobbins actually outnumbered the racks in our training, and that gives you a spectacular cross-section of cavers from the entire United States.
And it's not necessarily, I don't know, maybe you have a strong opinion about this, maybe you disagree, it's not necessarily that the bobbin is better than the rack, it's just that it's more internationally accepted?
No, not even that. It's that you use the right equipment for the right circumstances. If you're going to be going caving in America, if you're doing your IRT technique, if you're dropping pits in tag, you want a rack. I would never consider using a bobbin there because the rope and the design of the rigging calls for the rack. That's the, you know, that's what they're based off of. But if I'm going to be going up into some alpine caves in Colorado, I might consider going to a bobbin, so long as I have confirmation from people saying, yeah, we rigged this Alpine SRT style with smaller diameter ropes. Use the right equipment for the right job.
Ah, okay. Gotcha. All right. So let's kind of go through then what someone might expect when they go to Caving Academy. We kind of did a big overview, but like I said, you hit some points that I want to know more about. So if we start from the beginning, all right, so you get them at the airport, you take them to wherever you're going to be. What's day one?
So day one is actually the tour of Budapest. And one of the reasons for that is you've got a jet lag. You know, we want people to be well accommodated to the new time zone once we actually start training. So the goal is for everyone to arrive on September 7th. We'll pick you up at the airport, get you to some lodging, organize some activities for the day that they're specifically interested in. But honestly, a lot of people probably just want to sleep. But then the next day, we check out the tour of Budapest, Gellert Hill, Cave Church, Citadella, Castle Cave, Buda Castle, Hospital in the Rock, the Labyrinth. Check out either Semlo Cave or, I apologize, I'm American and I can't pronounce these foreign words once we start getting into them. Palvolgi Cave. We're going to have some dinner at Trophy Grill, which is a gorgeous buffet-based restaurant with all the instructors and all the students for everyone to meet in advance of the city. And then we'll take a walk home right along the river and across probably either the Margaret Bridge or Chain Bridge. And all of Budapest just gets lit up. And when you stand on the center one of these bridges, you just have these ancient, ancient buildings. You know, they're longer than America has existed.
Yeah,
all lit up at night. It's going to be a stunning first day.
Okay. And then what comes next? I mean, we don't have to go day by day, with details, but what comes next?
Then we start training, and training is it's an all day, every day type thing. We've got cliff site that we're going to be working at with numerous stations there to start building people. Honestly, it's kind of the combination of making sure that everyone's really dialed in on their Alpine SRT skills. The main focus of the course is rigging, but to be able to rig, you have to be really competent in just SRT in general. You're essentially on the sharp edge of caving when you're actually doing your Alpine SRT rigging. So we start off on the cliffs, make sure that everyone's dialed in, fine-tune any of the details, adjust systems, make sure that the gear is works well for that specific person. And then basically starting the next day, we're diving straight into caves. The training caves that we're using are up to 200 meters deep. And, you know, you basically have 3 days in a row of nonstop going to cave. And then what we do in cave is going to be rigging. While one person is pushing the rigging, a second person on that team is probably going to be working on their skills predominantly. And I I'm hesitant to use the term rescue because within Europe, often rescue refers to your team-based rescue. And this is much closer to the American small party assisted rescue or small party self-rescue skills, which is where you're not able to wait for a team to show up and rescue you. You're going to attempt to take a alert-oriented, conscious person who is able to self-ambulate to some extent and start working their way out of the cave. So we're going to find kind of the right balance of keeping everyone busy while rigging. And then as soon as the first person is rigged to the bottom of the cave, that second person swaps places. They evaluate all of that rigging, critique it, get to the bottom, de-rig, rinse and repeat day after day.
What is the expectation for skills that cavers come with that they already know? Like, where do they need to start in order to take this course?
No, it's a good question. So we definitely wanted to keep the entrance requirements, shall we say, gentle, that we are here to build expertise. And even if someone is a little bit less experienced, it's not going to matter for us. It's really just a question of how far that person is able to progress. We basically have skills, hierarchy, and prerequisites built into the course. So essentially, you're not able to start rigging until you have your solid Alpine SRT down. You can't start doing self-rescue techniques until your Alpine SRT is down. But you absolutely can work on rigging concepts even while you're still practicing your SRT. So the actual entrance skills are basically your knots, the foundational building blocks of everything that we do with rope work. So knots, bends, hitches, and then SRT skills is basically the ability to ascend, descend, do your soft lock off, hard lock off, do your changeovers, ascending to descending and the reverse, down climb. And then demonstrate the ability to essentially pass a knot slash rebelay. And there's no inherent time limits on this. It's just basically that you're safe and competent when you do so. You don't have to be great at it, just good enough to make it through safely where nobody's concerned. You know, from there, we'll take care of you. We certainly do encourage a certain level of physical fitness. If you basically figure you're going to be going 7 days in a row, you know, it takes a lot of energy to keep that going. But at the same time, if you're able to ascend over the course of a day, a couple hundred meters, you're going to be in good shape. You'll just start getting a little bit sore as each day goes by.
Well, so let's assume that there are a couple slots and someone's hearing this and they're like, all right, enough already. I'm sold. how much are we talking here? I mean, you got to pay for the plane, but what's the cost?
No, straightforward. So the course itself is $600. And then if you wanted us to take care of everything in that initial Budapest, I called it the Experience Budapest portion of the course, that's the additional $200. So total all-in cost, $800. It's for us to take care of absolutely everything for you. We do offer scholarships to people that have financial hardships. Little bit limited on this very inaugural course. We're already offering a discount to the original fee, which would be $800, just because honestly, we're learning as we go as well. This course is based off of the Hungarian Caving Instructor Committee's curriculum to a pretty solid extent. A lot of the instructors that are joining us are also Hungarian instructors within their framework, which has been established for well over a decade now. And it's one of the most comprehensive cave training organizations and curriculums that I've seen in Europe. But at the same time, this is the first time that we're coming in with a 100% international, 100% English-based course. All of the materials in English. Every single instructor is going to be teaching solely in English. So we're slipping in that discount to basically say, when we screw it up, give us a little bit of slack, you know?
All right. So let's recap then. When is this happening?
It is happening on September 10th through 16th. And if you want to arrive and depart on the perfect days, it'll be September 7th all the way out through September 18th.
Okay. And I know that you're probably focused on this, but you plan to do this again, right?
Absolutely. The goal is every single year. What we want to do is probably have like the flagship course maybe offered out of Hungary. That's where all these resources have been long established. But we also have really good interest out of Croatia, Montenegro, Turkey, a number of other Eastern Europe countries, and I could easily discuss opportunities to offer this course in other countries. And so one of my visions has been that we move from country to country. So we have no expectation that people would be able to learn all of the skills that we're able to offer when they come the first time. my rough estimate is that someone would probably have to attend this course maybe 3 times if they're not practicing and training and, you know, just going caving back home if they were just focusing on this course. And we want to make it a new experience every time. So we're going to rotate between countries, which could make that very exciting. So next year might be in Hungary, but it might be in another country.
Okay, so that's Caving Academy, and I'll put a link to where you can register if there's any spots left in the description of this podcast. But why don't you just go ahead and tell us right now where we can go to register.
You can head to www.cavingacademy.org. All the links are right there. Hit up Google Caving Academy, and you'll be able to find a pretty comprehensive website that lists all of our different courses that we can offer, resources, content of the course, schedule, skills booklet. It's all right there. And then if you want to run forward with the registration, just click on the registration button.
This is a pretty special thing that you are doing, but you gotta get to this point where you can be the person who offers this up. So let's talk about how that happened. Let's start at the beginning. What was the first cave trip?
I appreciate that, but I will say that I am not doing this alone. I definitely don't want to have anyone left out. There's a really strong group of instructors that have, you know, they're, as you're saying, you're asking me about my first cave trip, like they have amazing, amazing past experiences. They are highly involved in the caving world. I am honored to be able to work with the group of people that are essentially allowing this course to be able to happen. This is not a me thing. This is a team. I just happen to be the voice and, you know, chatting with you about it, but
sure.
Now there's amazing people that are helping out. Danish, Andras, Esther, Jolt, Judith, Jessica Van Oord, just great, great people with so many skills. They've been teaching for countless years at countless courses. So I appreciate the focus on me as well, but I don't want them to feel left out in the slightest.
Sure. Of course.
My first cave trip, man, I have to say that my memory is horrible. I can go with the usual tagline that I've been caving since the last century. It was definitely in the 1900s. Honestly, it's tough to remember. My parents were spectacular in that even when I was a really young kid, we were always getting out, always doing sports, always doing different activities. I guarantee that my first quote unquote cave trip would have been a commercial cave walking along one of those paths. But my mom is just as adventurous as I am, if not even more. And so we rapidly found a grotto. I highly expect. I'm young enough that I just don't even remember. But I do have these faint memories of getting in and doing like wild cave tours. And honestly, maybe it was a wild cave tour at a commercial cave. And then kept on pursuing all of my sports, and caving was towards the top of the list. Joined the local grottos around here, Skag, Schoharie County Area Grotto. And
which is where?
In New York, up northern New York, right around Albany, Schoharie County.
Is that home? Is that where you grew up around too?
I grew up in Westchester County, New York, so there's a couple grottos kind of surrounding this area, the Met Grotto in New York City, Central New Jersey Grotto, Northern New Jersey Grotto, Skag, and Skag was the one that I jumped onto. Yeah, I do remember that first trip very faintly. I believe that it was a surprise cave, which was an honor to be able to get to. Sadly, with a white nose syndrome, it's now closed and been closed since then.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I've got these faint memories of like, oh my God, this is amazing to truly have just this free form exploration of just dive into this cave. They let me jump down all these leads because obviously now I know that's what you do on these beginner trips. But back then I was just like, wow, they're letting me go first. They're letting me explore this passage and see what I could find. You know, the caving bug never left me.
Yeah, the bug bit you early, it seems like. It wasn't a slow burn. It was right off the bat, right on. So when did vertical come in then?
I would say the first time that vertical came in where there was like the real expectation of vertical competency was probably NCRC, National Cave Rescue Commission. It's interesting that NCRC actually represents probably the only national training organization that, while it's focused on rescue, of course, because the entrance skill sets include all these aspects of vertical, it pushes you to do more than just tie a rope to a tree and rappel to the bottom. And once you're at the bottom, you can then climb back out. You know, it's like, hey, a changeover actually exists. So I don't, you know, it's all perspective, but was I vertically caving prior to NCRC? I was tying a rope to a tree and tossing it down, sure. But the first time I really started to build into like you know, ascending a rope, doing a changeover, hanging out on rope, working while on rope, was when I attended NCRC. And that was back, I think the first course that I took there. Oh man, we're going back. It's either 2006 or 2008 was my first NCRC course.
Ah, okay. When I, and I haven't taken, you know, the week long or anything like that, but I've done
probably an OCR, orientation to cave rescue.
Orientation to cave rescue. That's right. And I don't have a ton of interest in rescue. I'm happy to be a hand if I'm needed, but I would recommend that course to anyone who is interested in just caving, period, because it makes you a lot more aware of what goes into a rescue, and it motivates you to not be the cause of a rescue, even though you can't help it when it happens. But taking care when you're in that moment and when you're going caving, taking a little extra care can prevent something bad. And so I think that it's important to do OCR and things like it. And so when that happened, did you look back then on the previous caving that you had done and think, man, I was really playing with fire with a couple of those techniques, a couple of those trips? Did you feel like you were being too risky at all in the past?
I appreciate that. And I'd have to say, if I didn't know from having listened to your podcast, you've spoken to many NCRC people. You just nailed a fantastic intro to NCRC. I'd also mention the SPAR course as being a great choice in addition to the week long, because I'm a SPAR lead instructor and run my own courses, but because it is a really great one for people that are more expedition cavers. No, I have to say that I had some really good people introduce me into caving. You get some horror stories out there. You know, one that I've heard is like, yeah, these people were teaching me how to do a changeover and they had the book open in front of them, you know, Alpine caving techniques in the process of teaching me. And I've heard horror stories throughout the countless years that I've been working with NCRC, traveling to Europe, and then, you know, comparing and contrasting European styles and mentalities against, you know, the American grottos, attempts to push Alpine SRT. And some grottos, though, I hear people that are beautifully on, and I have to say that it was beautifully on for me. I had some really strong people. They understood safety. They understood maintaining all the appropriate gear in your pack, not taking risks that were excessive, making calculated, careful choices of, yeah, you could probably climb that, but is it worth climbing that without rope? Because if you did fall, what would the outcome be? And continually saying, like, the deeper you get into the cave, the more cautious you should be, because the ramifications of an injury steadily increase until I escaped it for countless years, until finally when I was in Mexico in Charco, I finally had an in-cave injury that got me. But yeah, no, I managed to spend probably two decades basically injury free while caving, which is I was very happy about.
What happened in Mexico?
Oh, I shouldn't have given you that little lead.
you can't bury the lead like that, man.
that was a Cheve expedition, and I was jumped over to Charco upon request. They were really just digging for people because Charco had quite the reputation as being a exceptionally unpleasant cave, and people really just were not jumping on it. So myself, Jessica Van Oord, agreed to be the sacrificial lambs to increase the total number of people and help bring gear in and try to push that cave back down to the sump and possibly a dome climb that had never been pursued. And somewhere around camp one, heading back towards the surface, fell, dislocated my shoulder. I had actually dislocated my shoulder once before with a whitewater kayaking accident, and I'd had surgery and I was back to doing everything. Like, I wasn't one of those people that had a reoccurring dislocation. I had gone probably almost 20 years without a secondary dislocation, rock climbing 512s, no problem. Like, my shoulder was rock solid. So unfortunately this dislocation was not one of those, like, you know, oh, just pop it back in. It wasn't pleasant. I did happen to be an EMT, or I was an EMT once upon a time. I have some general wilderness medical experience. And so I was able to reduce the dislocation, got it back in, and just slowly and steadily worked my way to the surface. It dislocated a second time on my way. You know, Charco definitely has a reputation that is mostly deserved. For people that come out of New York with the New York style caves, it might feel a little bit on the roomy side, but for people that are used to giant borehole walking passage all day long, Charco's, that's a tight cave. Dislocated a second time, reduced it a second time, and took about 11 hours to get out what should have been about a 7-hour trip. I think it started off around maybe the 600 meter mark, so 1800 feet worth of vertical to get out of, and got to the surface, called out on the sat phone that was that we had, and got back to camp. When I got picked up, Bill Stone had apparently he was one of the people that was available. He came on out and it's just like, kind of asked the question, well, why didn't you get out of the cave sooner? Because it was right on the edge of when everyone was going to be leaving the main campus. Just like, I got out as fast as I could.
Yeah.
But no, it's not. It wasn't an exciting story. And I'm really happy to say that. It falls within that category of SPAR. Self-evaluate. Can you handle this? Do I need to go back to camp? 1 hour worth of travel, but going back downhill, wait for help? Or do you say, you know what? Yeah, I've still got three good limbs. I know what was behind me the entire way through. I knew the cave, knew the rope work. I had Jessica there to help me out. And I was confident that with just slow, steady travel, I'd be able to make it all the way back to the surface. And the compare and contrast, a SPAR versus a team-based rescue, plus the impact of resources of the overall expedition, it weighed so heavily on just get yourself out of there. And I think every caver does that.
I'm really glad that you shared that. I appreciate that, because that's something where if that happened to even a hardy caver, it would be enough to freak them out, And I don't want to know like where your head was when that happened, because it seems like you got it together and it seems like you went in with enough preparation and enough experience to know that, panicking is not going to help. And also to know that if you're able, you just white knuckle it and you get out of there if you're able. And you were able to make that call in the moment, probably in a lot of pain, and it took a while to get out. But I love the idea of SPAR, the Small Party Assisted Rescue, and the skills that you can gain from taking that course. It seems like you kept it together.
I got out. Yeah, no, I've spent many years in the rescue side of the world, whether it was above ground rescue. I'm the chief of the New Jersey Initial Response Team. I was in the fire department as a captain. I was a lieutenant in the EMS service. I've had your fair share of both witnessing from a distance emergency circumstances and then having, personal involvement. And even when it's an injury to yourself, you just panicking never helps ever.
Yeah, indeed. That's the main thing to remember. So let's talk about SPAR, Small Party Assisted Rescue.
Sure.
Because, man, when I first heard about SPAR, I thought there is something. I mean, it's a lot of commitment to do the NCRC week long. You've really got to kind of be into that idea of doing that. And it makes you a spectacular caver. You learn all kinds of things. But dialed back a little bit from that, and I think more applicable to your everyday cave trip, if there is such a thing, is SPAR. So can you just explain, give us an overview of what SPAR is?
Absolutely. Although dialed back, I don't know. I'll maybe touch on that.
And if I'm wrong about that, call me out.
No. So SPAR can be offered in a 3-day format. That's the shortest SPAR that is offered. And it is a fire hose of information and skills. And one of the aspects that students have said is like, this is spectacular. You are learning a wide swath of essentially those self-rescue skills, building up the basics, and mostly focusing on vertical when you're talking the 3-day SPAR. And one of the concepts is adjusting your response to be as safe as possible for the rescuer, getting the person off rope when they're trapped on rope, evaluating the injury, the cave, and determining whether or not it's possible to go for help. Even if you don't necessarily think you can get the person out, you could start movement with the patient, but also go for a call out. And all of these topics are covered kind of in the beginning of SPAR, but then SPAR just dives straight into techniques, movement techniques that are vertical, horizontal, patient medical treatment, sheltering in place, all of the things that would go into an emergency just hit, how do we deal with it? But 3 days just isn't enough time. So the last time I ran the 3-day SPAR here in New York, it was basically, I might be exaggerating slightly when I say unanimous, but pretty damn unanimous. It was just too much material in too short a time. So the next course I ran was 5 days long, which promptly got the exact same result of that's just not enough time for the material. We need to have a 7-day SPAR.
So it's not dialed back.
So it depends on each individual person, what region you go to, but the SPAR course is targeting, it's often spoken about as targeting your expedition cavers. And I think that is entirely wrong. And a lot of people have been modifying this in their presentation, but it doesn't matter if you're going on a 1 hour trip, a 7 hour trip, you're doing 28 hours, you're doing an expedition where you're bivvying underground for 5 days, someone can get hurt. And when they get hurt, they're still in cave. And when they're injured in cave, they still have to get out to be able to get to any form of definitive care. You're able to render some level of medical care in cave. And that's one of the amazing things in Europe, total tangent, but the amazing things in Europe is that their default is we are getting a medical doctor to every single patient. While in America, it can happen, but it's definitely not the focus. So right now on most caving trips, especially for SPAR, definitive care is get the person out. And even if it's a 1 hour horizontal trip, you still need to get them out. So I think the SPAR course is applicable to every single caver. If someone wanted to learn how to cave, I would encourage that they could take a SPAR course and it would not lead them astray in the slightest. Just because anything that you do to make yourself a safer caver, understand the risk versus reward calculations that go into your caving trips, and then to be able to actually effect that rescue, like everyone should take a SPAR.
What was your genesis with the NCRC? Would you say? I mean, it seems like you had a background, firefighting, EMT. When you first got involved with the NCRC, why was that?
Yeah, no, I was. That was when I was involved with the CNJG, which I think was a little bit more closely tied to the New Jersey Initial Response Team. The New Jersey Initial Response Team has been around for almost 25 years as predominantly a cave rescue team, also overlapping into your wilderness search and rescue, cliff, abandoned mine, but predominantly cave rescue. So one of the members of CNJG was also a member of the New Jersey Initial Response Team, said, hey, we're having a New Jersey Initial Response Team training. I think you would be a good fit. I know you do rescue service stuff. Come on out. I did that. I was just like, this is awesome. I started overlapping into taking an OCR. I started teaching regionally, took the NCRC level one, and then kind of sequentially took the level one, the level two, the level three, became an instructor and just never stopped.
And so what was the last thing you did for NCRC?
I just got back from Virginia teaching at the week long. That was about 3 days ago.
So pretty recently.
Yep. Yeah. Earlier this year, I just finished teaching that 5 day long SPAR course. NCRC is kind of I'll generally be teaching at 3 to 4 different NCRC events every single year, probably. You know, throughout the United States, it's an amazing family. It's an amazing group of people. The continual joke when people are at level one is that you can still get out if you leave now. NCRC is not just rescue training. It is the camaraderie of a fantastic group of cavers throughout the United States that are just amazing people. Every time people get back together, it's a family reunion.
I've had several NCRC affiliated people on the podcast. I just had fearless leader Gretchen Baker on. And so she was a delight to talk to. Yeah. It's just such important information. And I would encourage anyone to do it and get involved and, to at least find out when things are happening and whether or not you can make it. It's super, super applicable to just caving, not just for an interest in rescue, just being a better caver. Any kind of NCRC course will help with that. So let's go back to your personal caving life.
Absolutely.
So, what are some highlights from, we talked about the genesis, we talked about caving as a kid, and then, we got into some other stuff, but what else have you been up to? Like, where's the exploration taking you?
Oh, I think the one that always comes to mind first these days is it's either going to be Nadam in Croatia or it's going to be Kasaj Reaper Cave in Montenegro. Montenegro, this was there's a cave there, Reaper Cave. It eats you, it eats gear, it eats anything that gets thrown into it. It is hundreds of meters worth of just the tiniest meanders where you're evaluating, can I even fit through with my harness on? And yet you've got huge exposure underneath you, but you have to pick and choose the right places to fit through in a lot of places. And that cave has been on and off tried for a while. So again, I keep coming back to like the New York caving introduction for me, got me used to caving through places where you are barely squeezing yourself through. You're taking your helmet off. You're contorting yourself. You know, you're fully breathing out and restricting your breathing to be able to fit through stuff. And so whenever I hear, oh, that's a horrible cave, you know, that is insanely tight. Like, I just have to go to it. And Reaper Cave just kept going, and it just kept going tight. And this was the last day of the expedition in 2019. It was one more trip into Reaper Cave. And that was myself, Jessica Van Oord, my partner, Danish Naj, and Judith. And we were making a push. And we actually, for a moment, I was taking the lead, rigging all the way forward, dropped one last pit, which ended in, it wasn't even sump, just it just choked off with spots that were too small to fit through, no air movement. Water was flowing kind of just two different directions of this room. So I knew that it, you know, obviously the cave just kept going below. And I was in the front. I had reached that first. They were behind me, you know, continuing to push, survey, and clean everything up. And so I just start exploring that area, and I climb higher in that passage. And so probably, I don't know, 100 meters, yeah, maybe not 50 meters higher, give or take, there's this, the passage chokes off, but it chokes out in what is kind of just a pile of breakdown. And there's no visibility through, but I got nothing to do. And the rocks are somewhat loose, and I was able to find a safe spot that was under a solid rock plate above me, shall we say. So I felt that I was actually able to start just pulling this breakdown out of the way. And even if, you know, I released an avalanche, you know, I'd be perfectly fine. So I just started moving rocks out of the way, dropping them, you know, letting them know, like, I'm fine, I'm clearing some rocks. And I don't know, it probably only took about 10 minutes and was able to fit through this small body size triangular opening. And it suddenly broke open into a sizable room compared to all these tiny canyons that we had been working in for ages. And so I did a quick look around that room, and there was a dome climb in one spot. There were some tiny places that choked off, and I didn't see anything that kept going, but I wanted to get back to the team. So I pull out of that because I had gone a little bit farther into that room and into those passages, get back to them. And so I go back, and I forget, I meet up with Jessica. I send Danish and Judith on up there. They explore that room much more thoroughly. And Danish finds another small passage that leads off of it, and bam, we're talking borehole. We transition into giant, giant borehole pit with multi-second drops in them, passages going in like five different directions. We transition out of this newer canyon-based passage into old passage, and it was huge. On the last day of the expedition, when we have like 30 minutes left to leave that cave to get out by our out time, and we can't explore anything.
It's still very satisfying, though, to go through all of that hell and then finally be in a place where you can say, okay, we found the cave. We busted the thing open. Even though we can't stay, we at least know there's a reason to come back.
We did. And then COVID hit, so we couldn't even go back.
Oh, gosh.
So we made it back the year after. So 2021. Yeah, 2021. We made it back, and it's still going. It did connect to another nearby cave. We were wondering if it was going to go in that direction. My memory fails me. I believe that it caused that cave to return. I cannot pronounce the name of it. I have zero hope of pronouncing the name of that cave.
Yeah, unnamed cave in Montenegro.
But it returned it to being the, I think it's the longest cave in Montenegro again.
Oh, exciting.
So that connection added enough passage to reclaim the title in that country.
So when you connected to that other known cave, did that cut down travel time? Does it, for entrance to Frontier, is it shorter now?
Absolutely. My guess is nobody will ever go through Reaper Cave again. So they'll always be going in through the alternate entrance to get to the big section. Yeah, we made that connection.
And you said still going.
That was
going.
Exciting. That was a good one. And yep, so the new passages that were found are still going. We're still adding kilometers. That was exciting.
You've done a lot of European caving.
I have.
An awful lot. Would you say that that's the bulk of your exploration, or is that back home? Oh, it is.
No, I basically cave throughout the entire United States through NCRC, just traveling to state to state. And then I travel to expeditions in Europe. So, you know, Europe, it's been Hungary, Slovakia, Montenegro, Croatia, the UK, two expeditions in France, Spain, I will say I love Puerto Rico, Costa Rica. My God, I love nice, warm water compared to the alpine caves and freezing water coming in some of these places.
Yeah.
We've in Turkey, we've got a dome climb that's happening at 1,100 meters deep. And I'm jumping on this. You know, I'm not the lead. This is my first time for that expedition. But I was the sucker who agreed to help out with a dome climb in a waterfall at -1,100. And it's like... It's like, okay, how much of this are we even going to be able to use a drill? And how much is this going to be hand drilled? Because you're like in the waterfall and the beta is not quite there for me to know. And I checked out the prices for your actual waterproof hammer drills. And it's just like, yeah, I can't buy that.
Oh, no.
So we'll see what happens. But yeah, no, it's a cold water is my bane. I hate cold water. I've been hypothermic so many times that I'm just like, I avoid it in any way possible now.
Well, okay, when you're on an expedition like that and the expectation is you might run into some cold water like that. I mean, are you, I don't know. I mean, it's not my world. So I might need some education. Are you wearing wetsuits?
It's going to totally depend on the cave, on the temperatures, how long you're going to be under. My current plan for this one is because it's waterfall, but there's no submersion, is probably a full PVC suit with pushing, obviously, the hood, possibly a little bit of a neck grommet, wrist grommets, ankle grommets over the rubber boots. And the goal is under that to wear my normal layers, crossing my fingers that they won't get soaking wet, that I'll be at a basically be impermeable to that water. The other option is obviously wetsuit. I've done that numerous times. To me, that's way more common than a PVC suit. But if you're going to be not only dealing with water, essentially waterfalls or rappelling in waterfalls, climbing in waterfalls, but also with wading through water or even swimming in water, now you're going to be doing the combination of a PVC suit plus wetsuit plus layers. And this is why countless people have heard me over the years say I hate layering. It is so hard to figure out that perfect balance of every type of layer to deal with each aspect of the cave world that's trying to kill you.
Well, and not too much either, so you're not burning up in there. Or is
Absolutely.
That or is that often a risk when you're in alpine caves? It's cold enough as it is.
No, if you're working hard, you absolutely can. But you can always delayer. The problem is when you're going to that depth and you're dealing with, I need my full camp set up. I need food. So the Turkey one, I think the plan is 10 days underground with, I think, 7 of those days being at -1,100. So by the time you deal with camp, food, all of the supplies, all of the rigging supplies, rope, bolts, hammer drills, batteries, and then start adding in your layers, you're talking weight. Mm. And so having too many layers would be spectacular. It's like, oh yeah, just toss it into the pack, have them swap out between dry layers, wet layers, you know, slowly maybe try to dry out some layers in your sleeping bag, figuring those details out. But once you start dealing with those depths, like, I don't want extra weight on me.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to have to climb back out of this place.
Yeah.
So, and granted, you drop it down on food weight as you consume all your food, and that makes the climb out easier. But trust me, it ain't easy no matter what you do.
Indeed. Do you want to start hitting stories? Is there anything else you wanted to make sure you shared?
No, but honestly, to share with everyone, I've actually said this when I gave an intro to caving recently at a caving event, which is, and I basically started it saying, you know, I'm Mark Dickey and I've been caving for the last 2 decades and I have no idea what caves I've been to. I haven't kept a log. I don't have my caver book. It stinks.
Yeah.
Like, I've been...
It's never too late to start doing that kind of thing. And I say that at being a person who has not done that because I don't get to cave nearly as often as I'd like. But I at the same time feel like there's no reason for me to, because I'm the kind of caver who I am content to go back to the same places. Same caves, maybe not the same places in those caves, but the same caves over and over and over again. I like familiarity. I just like caving. I don't need to be the first person somewhere. I don't need to go to a frontier every time. I just like doing it.
No, absolutely.
But that's not the same the world over, for sure. You know, there are some people who never want to go to the same cave twice. Fine.
I'm kind of happy with everything. I enjoy every aspect of it. Honestly, teaching is probably one of my favorite activities, and not just teaching cave rescue. It's just teaching, honestly, teaching in general,
but anything.
Teaching cave rescue, yeah. Teaching alpine SRT, teaching IRT, teaching rigging, teaching anything to do with caves, expedition aspects, you know, jumping back to Caving Academy for just 1 second, just because it's related. you know, it's like, how do you bivvy in a cave? How do you actually go cave camping? What do you need to worry about? If you're going to be a trip leader, if you want to lead people on caving trips, what are the skill sets that you should have? What are the knowledge you should have? What's the preparations that you should do when you're dealing with a group of completely inexperienced beginners, an intermediate trip? You're leading a trip of experienced cavers, at which point you're herding cats and everyone also thinks they know exactly what should be done, when it should be done, how, you know, and you're trying to deal with this. And so the interpersonal skills of being a trip leader, expedition management is, so many people think about expeditions as focusing on all of your cave objectives, your research objectives, shall we say. And yet a successful expedition is really based almost entirely on logistics. Everything else is going to fall apart if you don't have a strong foundation covering your logistics, covering your supplies, covering your organization. It's your planning and logistics that can lead to really good successes in expedition. I don't want to say you can't succeed in an expedition no matter what, but it can make the difference. So I just love talking about this stuff and passing knowledge through to people that are excited. If someone else is excited, I'm excited. Like every single day at the NCRC week long that I was just teaching at, and I told every single person, I am going to be in the gym. And our hours are long, as you probably know from all the other people from NCRC you talk to. Hours ended at 10 o'clock, then I have an instructor meeting. So it's not like I'm giving people this great offer of, you know, at 5 p.m. I'll be available to work with you. Come on over in your spare time. There is no spare time. This is if you are dedicated enough to come back to the gym at like 10:30 p.m. and lose precious sleep, I will be there and I will work with you. You know, some people are dedicated enough, and some people might use the term stupid enough to come on by and do this. And I was working until like 1 a.m. almost every single night. Wow. You know, working on skills. No, I live for teaching, honestly. And then following that, I love exploration. I do love Virgin Cave. Another memory is Nedam in Croatia. It had been less than 300 meters deep when I came out on that expedition. And this one, you know, we were pushing down to the bottom of it. Again, crazy tight meander. That one, when I bolted the last spot, which was the widest one I could possibly find, there was no chemical persuasion being used at this moment. And so it was the widest spot I could find. I had to like strip my harness down to the barest minimums to be able to get past that constriction. But again, it just broke open into giant passage. And then we headed on out because that was kind of the end of that day and we needed to hit our out time. And of course, the next day, the next group that go in, they explored going in the same direction as that lead, higher passage. And they're, yeah, we could basically just walk through old passage and then just like bolt over here and drop down into what you found. That was like, my God, that was hell to get there. It's like I was scratching little arrows because I was in this meander where it's like you could look at the person a foot away. You could touch their hand, but it was probably like 15 minutes of finding the perfect slots in this meander to navigate around and through.
Oh my God.
Get that 1 foot. And I was continually terrified because I was getting into these spots. It was impossible to turn around, completely vertical. Like the vertical section that I was working in was at least 30, 40 meters tall. And you're moving up and down inside of this verticality, finding where the water had caused the passage to be just barely wide enough for you to fit through. It's like you're traveling through a maze, but it's not that you have solid walls blocking your way. It's you have passages that you just barely can't fit through with very limited actual ways to travel, but it looks like it's infinite.
Yeah.
And so I'm there scratching these tiny little marks to indicate, okay, this one's big enough I can travel, and then tagging this one is actually back towards my entrance. And I would work my way in a ways, work my way back out, memorizing the path, work my way in a ways, work my way back out, memorizing the path, traveling farther and farther each time.
Wow.
Until finally I broke through. And then the next day they come out and they were just like, yeah, we basically walked there. Because they followed a lead that was going in the correct direction that was much higher up.
When you were talking about teaching, you brought up something that I kind of latched onto, and that's personality management. I love that you brought that up. The fact that you might be the leader, but there might be other experienced people who want to take the lead. So how then do you teach how to deal with that part of it?
So entertainingly, that actually started the first time I had essentially an adult education course, basically teaching adults how to teach other adults, was through NCRC. It was the instructor qualification course. And that was led by John Punches, has been someone that I've looked up to for many years. And he is the one that always stands out in my mind. And it was a spectacular opportunity to learn that adult leadership. And then from there, I kind of continue to try to build on that. And I am far from an expert. So if someone is so dedicated to take level one, level two, level three, you can then apply to be an NCRC instructor and you will have the honor. And I truly say honor to be at to take the instructor qualification course. Currently the lead instructor for that is Bonnie Armstrong. And she's being assisted by Scott McRae. Fantastic course. And then obviously adult education exists everywhere. So how do you teach other people to deal with that? It's really tough and it's highly, personality based. And in the time frame that we've got, like I probably couldn't even scratch the surface breaking it down into personality evaluation. Basically you create, you have different categories of personalities and based on each category of personality, you interact with them contingent upon that. So some people even though they want to take the lead, they also desire to satisfy you, meaning they want to lead meeting your objectives and your outline. That is the easiest and best and most amazing person to lead. And that's the concept of leadership followership, that all of the attributes of a good leader and all of the attributes of a good follower are basically identical, with the only difference being while you're being a leader, your job is to make the final decisions and lead the way, while a good follower is there to provide input when it is appropriate. And one of the key terms is like, is it safe? Does it work? But to provide input, but then to follow the decisions that are made. It's literally just who makes the decisions and who follows those decisions. And so someone that is a great leader often can be a really great follower as well. And so those are the best people to work with. It's amazing. You just kind of tell them, these are the objectives. This is what we want to accomplish. And they're just like, here's my plan. Do you like my plan? And I'm just like, go make it happen. The exact opposite of that spectrum is going to be, your category of people. And there's just terminology for a lot of this stuff, but you kind of have to be in those systems for all the terminology to make sense sometimes. But it's someone that is very egotistical, very self-centered, very, I know what I'm doing. I'm an expert caver. I'm a professional. Not that there's such a thing as a professional caver, but like they exude this attitude of I am the answer to everything.
Yeah.
And my way is the way it goes. And working with that person is honestly almost is like the worst. And I hate to say, like sometimes it just comes down into almost a confrontation of establishing, you really appreciate their skill sets, their knowledge, their capabilities. You want to leverage that. But in the end, we have to be working together as a team. And you just sit them down, you have a talking to, and establish that you have the leadership of this trip, of this expedition. But then you immediately tone it back and you make sure that you feed back into their ego by, in front of everyone, you ask their opinion and you make them feel that they're still a major part of it. They're a major decision maker. But as long as you could turn that switch a little bit just to get them to get used to responding to you as the leader, you'll slowly move them into it. And that's just two random examples and it's far from comprehensive. Literally, this is week-long courses, covering these concepts.
So what I'm hearing, if I could boil it down just to make sure that I'm understanding, is it's kind of like saying you could look at someone who you might say is being problematic and you can either look at them as an obstacle or a liability, or you can look at it in a different way and you can look at them as a potential resource. And then if you look at them as a resource, that is feeding back into their ego, and then that can kind of quell whatever feeling they may have to want to take over the situation.
That sounds fantastic. You should come and be an instructor.
I don't know about that. I need to take a few courses before I can teach them.
You have a way with words, though. No surprise there.
So do you want to close with a story? We're at an hour, and Google Meet isn't kicking us off, so that's good.
That sounds great. We can hit one last story, which happened relatively recently, ties back to New Jersey Initial Response Team. And what I'm actually doing here is I'm giving a plug out to Jessica Van Ord, who is she is similarly spectacular in that she has been my partner for many, many years. And all of the travels that I've described and all the things that I've done, I've been doing it with her. And she has just as much experience. And honestly, I think that she's an even better people person than I am. I'm really focused on like getting the job done and achieving things. And like, what are my objectives? We need to get those objectives done. And if the objective is teaching, I'm really focused on people learning. And you don't want to know the words that people use for me at training when it's just like, you came really, really close to dressing that knot, but unfortunately it's not quite dressed yet, even though it's the 20th attempt.
Oh.
We're going to try again. Jessica, on the other hand, is just an absolute sweetheart and everyone loves her. And I honestly, I'm not putting that in the sense that people are in any way upset at me, but like, I have attention to detail. And it's like, your life is on the line when you're caving. Your life is on the line with this rigging. Your life is on the line when you're doing rescue work. But not only that, other people's lives are on the line with your rescue work. And so attention to detail is the thing that can often be the difference between, it's so dramatic, but like living and dying.
Yeah. You know,
the sometimes the fatalities are, there was just nothing that person can do. It was a horrible stroke of luck. A recent person took Stephanie Sue, and I apologize if I mispronounced that name, took a spar course that I led most recently, the 5-day spar course here in New York. 1 week later, she is self-rescuing with her party because of something that was estimated to be anywhere between 150 and 300 pound rock fell from the ceiling in Virgin Cave, glanced off of her or ricocheted off a wall and then bounced into her. She was in very substantial pain. And I heard this story when she came back to NCRC and she told it. I hadn't heard about it earlier than that. And it was literally that week after taking the spar course, and she had the equipment, she had the skills, she was able to walk other people through, you know, the necessary steps to be able to get her back out, along with the help actually of a French caver that was there, which obviously with the European mentality was fully familiar with spar style techniques, self-rescue, et cetera. So he was a fantastic resource for her as well. And so there was just nothing she could do about this injury and the resultant rescue. Not a single thing.
Yeah.
Like it just happens sometimes. But then you hear about the person that's at the bottom of a pit with a perfectly good rope rig there with their entire harness in perfect shape. And you have no idea how they ended up down there, but there was rope the entire way, meaning there was a proper approach line into proper rigging that led to the bottom of the pit, and they're on the bottom and you don't know.
Yeah.
And then you have the people that you really do know, that middle ground that you're just like, you know, that person was traveling in a way that would be a little bit less safe, shall we say, and it's preventable, or a knot was mistied and it actually came undone. You know, someone used an overhand instead of a figure eight and was too close to the edge. Tails were too short. Wear and tear on gear hadn't been evaluated. A rack wasn't inspected and the nut that's holding essentially holding the bars in place was loose and eventually fell off. American Caving Accidents is a spectacular resource for cavers just to read it. And I highly encourage people to do so because of the educational value of learning what are the things that go wrong and the opportunity to learn from other people's mistakes, however horrible sometimes they may be, and that you are reading about devastating events that are highly impacting to the caving world and to families. But that's what we need to learn from. Attention to detail, I think, is so important. And that's one of the aspects, back to Caving Academy, one of the aspects of Caving Academy is not teaching casual, let's just rig this. Oh, this rock looks good. Let me just put a bolt here. It's no, like, what are your fracture lines? What's your bedding planes like? Are you attaching to two separate segments, not segments, but two different independent rock bases? Are you bolting far enough apart? Are you looking at the rock and just saying, I can't find good rock here, I'm going to have to come up with a completely different solution? You know, Caving Academy has that mentality. Myself, Danish, both have this mentality of you will protect your life. You will protect everyone else's life. You will have a long, successful, you know, caving career, shall we say, when you have that attention to detail. So anyway, that was like kind of a random thing. I had actually started this off by chatting about Jessica. And this is what happens to me. I get distracted all the time.
That's all right.
Jessica is amazing. And one of the things that happened recently is that we got called out to a dog rescue. And I will leave the actual story to Jessica, but let me just say that dog was down there for a very unfortunate 5 days. We were called on the fifth day after a lot of different efforts were being made to rescue this dog. Jessica was successful. We got that dog out, and it was awesome. And it's strange that it might sound, the story part, and this is what triggered that thought, that story went international. That story of Jessica saving the dog reached far enough that the European Cave Rescue Association, which I'm actually an officer within that organization as well, Jessica has been attending their meetings. Someone from ECRA was like, I saw a story about you rescuing a dog in the United States. Would you like to give a presentation about that rescue at the next European Cave Rescue meeting? And so this, it's crazy how different stories get different levels of attention. There are, I don't know, like I've done a lot of stuff. I do totally admit that, but I've never been big into my own stories. Like I love hearing other people's stories. And in the end, yeah, have I done stuff that I'm really proud of and I think is really awesome? Yeah, but I don't do it for the story. And this dog rescue, like, just embodied that entire concept of the entire international news community latched onto this cute little dog, but a dog being rescued, while cavers go through crazy experiences and self-rescues, and the EMS service and the fire service and the technical rescue service are saving lives every single day. And this dog went international to the point that Jessica, like, someone came up to her in an event and was just like, I knew that you saved this dog and I brought you this newspaper clipping. And like, this is a picture on the front cover of you. Because that person knew that we, New Jersey Initial Response Team, was one of the primary responders to a wilderness event, and we ran safety for that event. And it's just, it's crazy. And so to me, I'm always most excited about other people's stories. So there's a plug for Jessica Van Org rescuing the dog.
I got to have her on to talk about it. But I understand, I understand what you mean. Like all of these extraordinary things happen, you know, every other weekend or whatever, you know, rescue, self-rescue, things like that. And this story about a dog is the one that caught fire. But at the same time, you and I both know that there are no shortage of cavers who do not want any attention, no matter how Absolutely. Extraordinary the story might be.
And that's where almost I'd close. Like, I've done a lot of stuff, yeah, and I'm trying to teach this Caving Academy course, but my ability to do so, there are amazing people out there, and every single one of them has been so important in building the caving community as a whole. Like, we are where we are because of all of these people, you know, like the honor of going to Berger and assisting with expeditions there and cleaning up that cave, which was like the first sub 1,000 meter cave. You know, that was, you know, Petzl himself exploring that cave. Wow. And being able to travel down to the sump in that cave at 1,128 meters, I think. And like standing at that sump, looking at it and being like, this is where Petzl probably broke down, swearing his head off, because he's like, crap, this cave doesn't go anymore.
Never mind how extraordinary it is when he's there in the first place.
I know, exactly. It's just like, that's what came to mind when I was standing there. It's just like, God, he must have been so pissed off right now.
Mark, it has been such a pleasure. I really, really appreciate your time, and best of luck with the Caving Academy.
I appreciate it. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
Oh, it was so kind of Mark to be so generous with his time. Mark, thank you. And again, there is a link to the Caving Academy website in the description of this podcast if you're interested. And you can afford a transatlantic plane ticket with a month's notice. cavingacademy.org. And let's see, next month, you know, I don't know what I'm doing next month. I've got an interview in the can. I'm also going to Cave Capers. If I get some good interviews at Cave Capers, I might do a Cave Capers thing. I don't know, but I'll have something September 1st. I'll see you then. All right. Thank you to our sponsors, past and present. El Spilio. Get that light you've been thinking about. Swego, swegogear.com for that shiny new Swego pack. If you're coming to Indiana Cave Capers, I'm sure we'll have a vendor selling Swegos. And Charlie will be there too. He's our fearless leader, our chairman for the Central Indiana Grotto. His website is organicrobotdesigns.com, and he'll have some t-shirts, I'm sure. If your grotto needs t-shirts, he'll do custom orders. He's got that brick and mortar shop in Greenfield, Indiana. Anyway, Charlie's the best. I'm Matt Pelser from the Central Indiana Grotto. Until next time, kill nothing but time.